From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
NAFTA, the Canadian government, and the Democratic campaign. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Obama and Clinton are looking for votes in Mississippi tomorrow, but last week's flap over NAFTA is still on the radar screen. Turns out that both campaigns reassured the Canadian government about political posturing over NAFTA, but Ohio voters heard only about Obama. On To the Point, was Canada's conservative government interfering? Meantime, as Clinton escalates her attacks, Obama's beginning to respond in kind. Are they handing John McCain issues to use in November? Will their ongoing battle make it harder for him to get the attention he needs to rally Republican skeptics? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the age of the universe. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Obama and Clinton are focused on tomorrow's vote in Mississippi, but the hangover from last week's NAFTA flap in Ohio is not over yet. On To the Point, we'll hear about the role of the Canadian government. Does renegotiating NAFTA make sense? Are Obama and Clinton providing material for John McCain in November? On Reporter's Notebook, the oldest story of all, the age of the universe, what happened in the first trillionth of a second? First, this news update. Prescription drugs and over-the-counter medicines are part of the water supply serving at least 41 million Americans. That's the finding of the Associated Press after a five-month study involving hundreds of scientific reports and interviews with more than 230 officials and academics and scientists. Martha Mendoza co-authored the Associated Press report. And Martha, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
What are some of the pharmaceuticals that are in some water supplies?
Well, there were antibiotics. There were anticonvulsants, there's mood stabilizers, there's sex hormones. There were, in fact, dozens of different pharmaceuticals in different communities' drinking water supplies.
Both over-the-counter and the prescription-type drugs.
Absolutely. Things like caffeine or metabolites of nicotine show up very often.
In what quantities?
These are in minute quantities. These are in parts per trillion, far below the levels of a medical dose.
So why do we care?
Well, there is a body of emerging scientific studies that indicate that over time, humans could be harmed by drinking water contaminated with tiny amounts of pharmaceuticals. This could be decades that people are exposed to these, and in combinations that perhaps we wouldn't be taking them as prescription medications. Furthermore, there's vulnerable populations, pregnant women, people with kidney problems, perhaps. In the laboratory, when they expose human embryonic kidney cells or blood cells or breast cancer cells to these minute traces of pharmaceuticals, these cells react with problems.
How do the pharmaceuticals get into the water supply in the first place?
People take pills. Their bodies absorb some of the medication, but the rest of it passes through and is flushed down the toilet, or people simply throw their medications into the toilet, which is how we were taught to do it earlier in the century. The wastewater is treated before it's discharged into reservoirs, rivers, or lakes, but then some of the water is taken back up. It's cleaned again at a drinking water treatment plant and piped to consumers. The EPA says there's no sewage treatment systems in this country specifically engineered to remove pharmaceuticals.
Could it be? Could they be engineered to do that?
As for sewage treatment systems, in Europe they are looking at some systems that do this. Drinking water systems also generally are not removing pharmaceuticals specifically from water, except for reverse osmosis. And here in the West, that creates yet another problem because reverse osmosis is a water treatment that uses a lot of water in the process of making clean water.
Again, Martha Mendoza is a national reporter for the Associated Press. Now, a lot of the water supplies you found where this occurs are in the West, as you just mentioned, and people can look at a map if they want to know where this is happening. How do they get to that map?
Well, I suppose you would want to do a Yahoo or a Google search for the Associated Press pharmaceuticals and water story. We're a nonprofit that serves our members, so we go to radio, TV, and newspapers and websites, and they put it up.
Okay. So again, if people want to know that, that's where they can find it. What did the water utilities say when you asked them about this issue and whether they were, A, aware of it, and B, doing anything about it?
Well, what the water utility providers said usually was, we don't test for these things because we're not required to test for these things. The federal government has no regulations requiring anyone to test. I was really surprised doing this project to find that when water providers do find pharmaceuticals in their drinking water, they rarely tell the public. And when researchers make the same discoveries, they usually don't identify the cities involved. And there's a lot of reasons for this secrecy. They have concerns about national security. They talked about fears of people panicking, a feeling that the public will not understand. There's even a lot of confidentiality agreements between researchers and cities that allow their water to be tested.
So this is not obviously an easy thing to come by, this kind of information. Did any of them indicate that they plan to take action as a result of the findings that the Associated Press put together?
Well, this is a little early to say because our findings are only coming out today. I think there is indeed going to be a response, certainly in Philadelphia, where they had screened for a vast amount of pharmaceuticals and detected 56 different pharmaceuticals in their water. Already there's a congresswoman trying to figure out what type of legislation she could pass that would impact this in a positive way.
Again, you say that over time, new research indicates that there may be effects, but is that solid evidence at this point, or is it at the moment uncertain?
The impact on humans is an open question. Really, the analytical chemistry that has allowed people to find out whether this is in their water is only now coming along. However, when it comes to the environment, the impacts are confirmed and the impacts are a problem. The pharmaceuticals are being blamed for severe reproductive problems in many types of fish. Some male fish are producing egg yolk proteins typically made only by females. There's female fish that have developed male genital organs. There's vultures, down-to-earth worms have been impacted by this.
Okay. Well, Martha Mendoza, many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Again, a national reporter for the Associated Press. In a moment, NAFTA, the Canadian government, and the Democratic campaign on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Last week, U.S. Ambassador David Wilkins complained that the Canadian government had interfered with the U.S. political process. At issue was the flap over NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which began during a Clinton-Obama debate in Ohio. Both promised publicly to pressure for renegotiation of NAFTA. CTV, the private television network in Canada, then reported that an aide to Obama had privately reassured Canadian officials not to worry. It was all political rhetoric in a state where NAFTA is blamed for a loss of jobs. The Clinton campaign accused Obama of dishonesty, and the issue contributed to his loss in Ohio. Susan Delacorte is senior political writer for the Toronto Star. And Susan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This gets very complicated because among the things we have learned since then is that the Clinton campaign also reassured Canada that this was political rhetoric. Did these things happen at different times?
Well, it's very hard for us. It's like, as you say, it's very complicated. It's like doing forensic analysis on where this all started. But what seems to be clear is we have something. I'm not sure you have it down in the States. It's called a federal budget lockup, and they to prevent any information from the federal budget getting out into the markets, all the reporters are locked up for a day, and we get to look over the budget, and then it's released after the markets close. So all the prime minister's officials, government officials, are also in this lockup, and in this lockup it said that the prime minister's chief of staff was talking to a bunch of reporters and told them, and this is where it gets a little foggy, told the reporters that Clinton and Obama, I think, had offered reassurances that this was all just campaign talk down there.
Okay.
And that's how the story all got started.
But the CTV was the one then that broke the story. It only reported about Obama.
Yes. Yeah, and I'd be careful about sounding churlish about a competitor, but it's been pretty much pretty much assumed here ever since this conservative government came into power that their natural allies are the CTV network, the Canadian television network. They, if the government has messages it wants to get out, it tends to put them out through CTV. So we're not sure who was acting for who or why CTV only took the Obama angle, but I can tell you that opposition politicians here are having a field day with this. They see the conservatives as they're calling our conservative government here the Republican farm team, and that they were trying deliberately to meddle in a campaign to hurt the Democrats.
CTV, a private television network, different from the Canadian Broadcasting Company.
Which is state-owned, yes, and it's the national broadcaster. It's like the BBC would probably be the closest comparison. The British Broadcasting Corporation, for those familiar. So, yes, ever since the Conservatives have come into power, it's basically been, the best example is we have a year-end interview with prime ministers. All the networks get it. CBC, the state-owned broadcaster, got 10 minutes, and CTV got an hour and a bit.
Okay, so there may be this relationship then, but why would the Prime Minister of Canada be more interested in revealing information about Obama than Clinton?
Well, I can't say. Again, we don't know that he did. My understanding is they both said the same thing, but they said the same thing about both of them. I'm sort of at a loss how this whole thing got started, and I think Canadians are partly bemused, partly embarrassed that we got so deep in this. Obama is very popular up here. He's more so than Hillary Clinton, I would say, and that's very unscientific. We had a poll, though, back here on Friday that showed that if Obama was leading any of our Canadian political parties, their support would double. So, yeah, if you don't elect him down there, we'll take him.
Okay. I understand. And once again, back to the original information that was passed by the campaigns to the Canadian government, it's my understanding that in one instance it was Obama's advisor speaking to a member of the Canadian government, and in the Clinton side, they apparently got in touch with the embassy in Washington. Is that correct?
Yes, and our reporter today in Washington, the Toronto Star's reporter, is actually we're still trying to get an answer or some answers from Michael Wilson, our ambassador down there, about who said what when. But Mr. Wilson has been very, very quiet since this all started.
Okay, except for having, your ambassador.
Yeah.
But then there's the U.S. Ambassador David Wilkins up in Canada.
He is not, yes.
He has not been quiet about it at all.
No, although he did have to be prodded. I listened to the whole interview on Saturday, and he himself, Mr. Wilkins, Ambassador Wilkins, sort of waded into our Canadian election campaign in 2005, and he was not very popular for doing that. So he was very, very wary about getting dragged into this one, too. But eventually, the interviewer kept asking, was this political interference, And he said, yes, it was interference. So, now, what we're all still trying to sort out here was whether it was deliberate, whether it was accidental, a little bit of both, a little bit of mischief. But as we're talking here, our question period, which I don't think you have down there, has just started in the House of Commons, and that is sort of, it is the issue of the day. It's going to hang around for a while, it looks like.
So whether Clinton and Obama continue to make it an issue or not, it's going to be an issue in Canada for some time to come.
I think so, yes, because it's it neatly sort of fits into our political battles up here, too. And for a long time, the opposition parties have been getting some mileage out of trying to paint the Harper Conservatives as Republicans.
Okay. Susan Delacorte again, senior political writer for the Toronto Star. Let's talk a bit about NAFTA and what this threat to renegotiate really amounts to. Gary Hufbauer is a senior fellow and trade expert at the Peterson Institute for International Economics that bills itself as a nonpartisan organization. And Gary Hufbauer, good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
What they were saying was that if either were elected to president and they vied to see who was going to be tougher about this, they would require that Canada and Mexico renegotiate some of the labor requirements and environmental requirements in NAFTA. Does that make sense?
Let me put it a little bit in context. I recall that Russert had to push both candidates very hard before they came up with these opt-out statements if there is not renegotiation.
So Tim Russert of NBC, you're right about that. Yeah,
correct. And so neither Clinton nor Obama was volunteering that they were going to withdraw, right? So it's very important. They were pushed into this kind of strong rhetoric, which got a lot of attention. Secondly, they've now committed themselves to renegotiate and to talk about labor and environment. There are a lot of ways that could be done, and some of them could actually be fairly constructive. So if we want to look at the glass half full, this is a chance for NAFTA to get back on the agenda. It's been off the public agenda now for 15 years. Remember, it came into force in January 1994, so it'll be 15 years in January 2009. And there are a lot of things that could be constructively changed, or it could go in a very negative direction. But my guess is that in office, either President Clinton or President Obama would go in the constructive direction, because we have so many issues, both foreign policy and economic, with both Canada and Mexico.
What about the argument in Ohio that NAFTA caused people to lose their jobs?
Well, this is baloney, not to put too fine a point on it. It did cause job churn, but when somebody like Senator Obama says a million jobs were caused by NAFTA, what he's really drawing is an image of Mexico costing Ohio a million jobs, or costing the U.S., a million jobs, and then he said 50,000 jobs in Ohio. Serious scholarship does not support either of those numbers on an annual basis. He did not say the time length. Remember, this has been in place for now about 14 years. So if you add up 14 years of job churn in the United States, well, you probably know, but most people don't know, that it's 16 million jobs a year churn. That is change. People lose their jobs, people gain their jobs every year. Well, you take that for 14 years and you're up to about the 200 million jobs. So, you know, you get the million jobs on account of NAFTA. That puts it in perspective. It is not a very big factor in the job picture. But another thing that was not mentioned, and it's very important, is guess who Ohio's biggest trade surplus country is? It is Canada. And Ohio sends 50% of its exports to Canada. Well, did that get mentioned? Of course it did not. So you've got a lot of demonizing, which is unjustified.
Okay. Constructive renegotiation then would involve what?
Well, we have issues with both Canada and Mexico, and with the world on energy. And Canada is our biggest supplier of energy to the United States. Again, I'm sure you know, but it's not widely known that Canada far exceeds Saudi Arabia as a supplier of energy to the United States. But we want more energy. We'd like to have more from Mexico as well, which has been quite lagging, if you have any meaning in this phrase, energy independence. But we also, looking ahead, we have climate change issues, and if we can't work out systems with both our northern and our southern neighbor, how can we work them out with the world? We have agricultural issues, many of them with Canada. We have fairly free agricultural markets with Mexico, but not with Canada. And those need to be sorted out. We have the trucking issue, which also has gotten into the campaign, which is really a Mexican issue. And there's regulatory issues on standards. You know, the same thing you eat in Toronto when you go there, it can't be shipped to the United States, or the same item you eat in Seattle can't be shipped to Canada because we have different food safety standards, and on. So there's a big unattended list of issues which could be constructively addressed by all three of our countries.
Jerry Huffbauer, again, senior fellow trade expert at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you for attributing to me a knowledge about NAFTA and the kinds of dynamics that you're talking about. Susan Delacorte is still with us, the senior political writer for the Toronto Star. Just interested in what Canadian reaction has been to the issue regarding NAFTA, not just the question of the prime minister's involvement in American politics or U.S. politics, but rather the issue of NAFTA, particularly with regarding Ohio.
Well, we have some of the similar economic problems happening here to manufacturing job losses, you know, in the tens of thousands, especially around the border. And it, part of it is the exchange, the difference in the exchange rate or the falling U.S. dollar. So we've had some people blaming NAFTA and blaming the United States, but we have we basically have two parties, liberals or conservatives, that could form government. Right now it's conservatives. It has been the liberals. They are both fans of free trade. They have both done their part to protect this thing. And I think among sort of the established political parties, the idea is we don't want this thing opened up. It's done more good for us. It's created a lot of jobs. We do have a party on the left of the spectrum, the New Democratic Party, that it would be happy to see NAFTA opened up and happy to sort of repatriate what they think are Canadian jobs lost to the United States.
Gary Huffbauer, back to you. Both parties in the United States, it seems to me, certainly are on record in support of free trade. After all, it was President Clinton who signed NAFTA in the first place. What about Pennsylvania? Is that a place where the same kinds of claims are being made that were made in Ohio? Would you expect that this issue might come up there again?
Well, let me just correct you a little bit.
Oh, sure.
The Democratic Party under Clinton, when NAFTA was ratified and then the so-called Uruguay round of the WTO talks was ratified, that was the last time it gave substantial support to a free trade agreement.
Okay.
And since Clinton's time, that was back in 1994, it really has drifted against the free trade agenda, and we see that now being played out in the primaries. Now, coming quickly to Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania issues are similar. I don't think they're as acute as in Ohio. You take a town like Pittsburgh, it has remade itself as a service city, and just doesn't have some of those issues that you might find in Youngstown and some other of the Ohio cities. Both states really have a lot of fish to fry, especially with Canada. Neither is much impacted by Mexico, despite all the talk. I realize that NAFTA has become a kind of a code word for globalization generally, but in any event, both states do a lot of business with Canada. But I expect this rhetoric to replay in the hotly contested Pennsylvania debate, but I'm hoping in a more modulated and constructive way. Maybe that's a futile hope.
You say that the Democrats have drifted against NAFTA. Do you expect against free trade?
Yes.
How specific have they been, though, before this? And as you said, Tim Russert had a hard time pulling this out of the candidates. Do you think this will be an issue with John McCain in November?
Oh, definitely. Now, if you go back in history, there have been candidates, presidential candidates, who have tried to raise the trade issue, but it never got very much off the ground. However, I think this time, not trade only, but if we tie into the whole global economy, sovereign wealth funds, Dubai ports, et cetera, China, the rise of China, I think that this nationalism issue will be
okay.
A good number two issue in the 2008
right.
election.
We are out of time. Gary Huffbauer, a senior fellow and trade expert, Peterson Institute for International Economy, many thanks. And Susan Delacorte, a senior political writer for the Toronto Star, thanks to you as well. We'll come back and talk more about the campaign and talk about the oldest story of all on our notebook, The Age of the Universe.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, introducing now John Harris, editor-in-chief of Politico, co-author of The Way to Win, taking the White House in 2008. John, thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, good afternoon.
We were talking about the NAFTA flap, which is certainly going to continue, as well as the free trade argument in the campaigns. But let's talk a bit about what they're doing today. Obama today in Mississippi said he doesn't want to be vice president. Where did that idea come from?
Well, the Clintons obviously are pushing the idea. They've got to somehow convince the so-called superdelegates, the party insiders, that even though Obama is maybe a little bit ahead in the pledge delegates, that she's the better candidate. That's obviously hard medicine to swallow, and so they're floating this idea of Obama maybe being vice president. He swatted that down hard today. He said, look, they've been spending the last 3 weeks, the Clintons, saying I'm not ready to be president. Why would I be ready to be vice president? Really subjecting it the whole idea that the second place candidate can offer the first place candidate a position on the ticket, kind of treating it with scorn.
Called it gamesmanship.
Exactly.
In the meantime, they and we'll talk more about the nature of the campaign and the quality of the rhetoric in a minute, but what about Florida and Michigan? What are the Democrats finally going to have to do about that?
You know, it's an absolute mess. You go back to 2000, you recall, like, Democrats were all outraged by what they saw as, a hijacking of democracy in Florida. And, you know, here the party is presiding over this total mess where it's got two kind of untenable situations. One, don't seat Florida and Michigan because they broke the party rules. How can you not seat the two biggest states at your convention? Or two, seat them, but how can you do that when they didn't have full contests with both candidates' names on the ballot? Howard Dean, the DNC chairman, has got a total mess on his hands. Some people are saying, look, the only way out of this is to basically have a revote, go have a real contest there. Big question there, who's going to pop for this? It's not easy. It's not cheap throwing an election. It would cost several million dollars. The states, for obvious reasons, are not enthusiastic to have to pay for essentially a mulligan.
What about the mail-in ballot proposition? Would that, in fact, save money, and could either Florida or Michigan pull it off?
They could do it. There'd be a lot of speculation and analysis over, who that would help and who'd have the advantage in a situation like that. Hillary Clinton, the one thing she has been able to, a case she's been able to make pretty effectively is that she has run better in big states, run better than Obama has, and these are both big states. And so her folks think that even on a revote, she could win just as she did the first time. Obama typically has better on-the-ground organization. If he could use that to make sure that all his supporters, mail-in ballots, be a test of his organizational strength. Anyway, this is not going to get solved anytime soon, it does not look like. It certainly seems that this race is going to continue beyond Pennsylvania, probably into the summer, before we know who the Democratic nominee is going to be, Warren.
What about the Obama campaign and some of its advisors who've gotten him into trouble by making, in one case, the case of NAFTA, caught advising the Canadians that this was just political rhetoric. Turns out that the Clinton campaign did the same thing, but it wasn't reported by the Canadians right away. And secondly, Samantha Power, the foreign policy advisor, calling Hillary Clinton a monster in an interview with a Scottish newspaper and therefore having to resign. How important are those incidents, do you think, in terms of the running of the campaign? The Obama campaign seems to have been so extraordinarily well run up until now, have they kind of lost control of their people?
Well, Warren, I think you're, if you talk about those individual episodes, they're small. And the question is, do they raise, they add up to something big, which is that this Obama team, which has for most of this campaign season really run a brilliant campaign, are they now sort of wilting a little bit under the scrutiny that front runners inevitably get in American politics? You were nice enough to mention at the top a book I co-authored with my colleague Mark Halperin called The Way to Win. And what we argued in that book was that modern politics is so punishing, and that the most effective candidates are the ones that recognize the perils and the threats that constantly lurk in our media culture. And politicians in the space of a 24-hour news cycle can lose control of their public image. Now, Hillary Clinton's had a lot of experience with this, how to keep control of her public image. She knows all the perils of this modern media culture, what we called in the book the freak show. Barack Obama does not have as much experience with that. And so this is going to be a big test. It's going to be one of the things Democrats are going to be looking at as they decide who would be the better candidate to face John McCain in the fall. Who is the one who's going to more equipped to deal with this really damaging environment, keep control of his public image? This is a real test for Obama.
On the other hand, for all of her ability to control her public image, we've been seeing a lot of stories about the infighting going on in the Clinton campaign, and it's over not just how to present herself or which state to campaign in, but over substantive issues as well.
Yeah, I couldn't. Certainly a lot of strategic issues about where she should campaign. campaign, what she should, what issues she should emphasize, where she should direct her resources. And you're absolutely right. Campaign infighting is one of the things that the freak show dines out on, and really does present a peril for Hillary Clinton to lose control of her image. You know, I think what's interesting is that even though the Hillary Clinton's campaign is not over, a lot of her aides and the different factions in her campaign kind of went into score settling mode, operating under the assumption that they were about to lose. You know, a lot of them thought that she was going to be out of the race last week if she lost Ohio and Texas. Of course, she won those. But it looks like already people are, you know, even though she won, are sort of busy covering their tracks. And that's often what you see. It tends to be a feast for people in my business, reporters, you know, losing campaigns are a gold mine because everybody wants to explain why it wasn't their fault. Their advice was brilliant. It was that other guy who screwed it up.
Just a little more on the Freak Show. You're on this program with Politico. I'm on this program with Public Radio. We're going to have in a moment David Korn, the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones, and Bill Greener, who's a former spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. Are we all part of the Freak Show?
You know, I think the people you mentioned are all responsible, either political operatives or journalists. The freak show is the term that we use for the media culture, which is more interested in not winning an argument, but destroying an opponent and casting him or her as just fundamentally unfit, unworthy. And it's based on the incentives that now exist in politics and in media toward the more extreme statements, toward more ideological purity as opposed to difference splitting and problem solving.
So you're talking about what comes out of the campaigns and then gets picked up by the media.
Right. And often the you know, we do see in this hyper-competitive news environment that it tends to be sensational stories, personal stories, stories that feature an accusation, that feature confrontation, that feature a sort of dramatic personal element. And, you know, so...
Okay. Got the point. John Harris, again, editor-in-chief of Politico and co-author of The Way to Win, taking the White House in 2008. David Korn, first to you, bureau chief in Washington for Mother Jones. Are the candidates now getting into the freak show? Are they accusing each other of being unfit and unworthy?
Well, you certainly have that in the case of the Hillary Clinton campaign. I wrote a couple weeks ago that she was making accusations about Senator Obama's Iraq position that were not supported by the facts. And when I asked the campaign to back up their assertions and things that she was saying, I didn't get, you know, good evidence. But in the last week, you have Hillary Clinton once, and now earlier today, Howard Wolfson, her communications director, you know, both saying that, well, John McCain and Hillary Clinton have proven that they can be commander-in-chief, but it remains yet to be seen if Barack Obama can meet that test. That's about as harsh a thing as one can say about an opponent, particularly one in one's own party. So I think, you know, while, you know, earlier in the campaign, and certainly before Obama became competitive, she wasn't making these harsh points. She is now, and hoping that the, you know, that she's able and her campaign people are able to shape the debate and the discussion and discourse of the campaign and how the media covers it. They make this charge, the media reports it dutifully, and then it sort of puts the other campaign in the position of having to respond, which is by nature, by definition, a defensive position, and most candidates don't want to be in such a position.
Well, what has Obama done? And for example, the Clinton campaign is saying that she's somehow has proven her ability to be commander-in-chief, certainly Obama has to respond to that, doesn't he?
Well, I think he has to at this point in time. I mean, well, they put out the ad, you know, over a week ago, the 3 a.m. ad, yeah. And the Obama people responded very forcefully to that, but, you know, not sufficiently, or maybe not, you know, there was enough time for it to, you know, win back the elections for them in Ohio and Texas for the popular vote and in Rhode Island. So I think, when you throw a pretty sharp charge at somebody, you're inviting one back, and it's going to, you know, change the tenor of the debate, and the freak show that John just discussed will now have plenty of freaky material to publish and broadcast.
David Corn, again, the Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. Bill Greener is a Republican strategist. He was spokesperson for the Republican National Committee in the 1980s. And, Bill, good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is this ultimately working in favor of John McCain, or does he have to now compete to get time when he has a lot of skeptics in his own party and needs all the coverage he can get?
Well, I'm not sure that the challenge to Senator McCain in terms of consolidating his support, especially among the base, is such that it's of a nature that it requires a lot of attention, number one. Number two, I just don't think that the proof in the pudding about this not being good for the Democrats is listen to the Democrats that are not involved in the campaign talking about how this has to come to a stop. And so it's just hard for me to understand how anybody could reach a conclusion that what's going on in the Democratic primary right now is good for the Democrats.
Well, what about Senator McCain, though? You say he doesn't need a lot of attention to get all those conservatives, particularly those on talk radio who are trashing him on a daily basis?
Well, I think there's a little more talk of it than there is reality of it, number one. Number two, he's done pretty well among actual conservatives. And some of us are so old, we remember when Ronald Reagan was the subject of ire from some people who decided that they were the real conservatives. And so I think Senator McCain's challenge to unite the party is one that he is about the business of accomplishing. And I don't think it's the kind of thing that that requires a whole lot of media attention to get done.
So are the Democrats then, by sort of mobilizing the freak show, the term we're now using on this program, really damaging their own case?
I would say so. I would say also, though, I think that the Clintons are unique in being somewhat comfortable in a soap opera sort of circumstance. They've been through this kind of stuff for a long, long time, and it's almost as though she hits her stride when it gets ugliest and nastiest.
And let me go back to John Harris with Politico. She said a couple of times, "We're just getting started."
That sort of plays off the point just being made.
Yeah.
She does relish this, and both Clintons have been around the block. They're good at this brand of politics. I don't know that they, I think in their ideal, they would not have to wage this kind of campaign, but we're far from the ideal with her in second place. I do think this is a kind of a phase of hand-to-hand combat, if you will, that they're more experienced at and more comfortable with than Obama is.
So, David Corn, back to you. This does put the Obama campaign and the senator himself in a very difficult position, in as much as doesn't it turn out that many times this kind of campaigning is successful. You bloody up the opponent enough that you either make it impossible for him to continue or you actually defeat him.
I think all of us on this call would agree here that the reason why candidates and campaigns do this is because often, usually, if not always, it does work. The public always says they don't like negative ads, but negative campaigning, but it tends to, do the job. And I think John had it right in talking about the Clintons' ability or talent, if one wants to call it that, at hand-to-hand combat. I think what happened really in the days before Ohio and Texas is that they sort of, to be metaphorical about it, got the meds right. By that I mean they got the right mix of negative ads and attacks, and they finally felt like they were grabbing hold of Obama's tail. Up until that point, they'd thrown a lot of things at him. They'd ratcheted up the attacks, pulled them back, and nothing seemed to have a lot of impact. But you got the sense from talking to people in the Clinton campaign starting in the beginning of last week that they were finally confident and pretty pleased with themselves for having created a kitchen sink approach that sort of had everything in the right proportions. They got the recipe right, and they were. And I think it has thrown the Obama people off their game a little bit. And the Clinton people were helped with some lucky breaks. The trial of Tony Rezko started. There was the NAFTAGATE screw up that on the Obama campaign side, and they've gone to town. And I think they're going to just keep digging the knife in further.
Bill Greener, back to you. Republican Mark Mellman and Karl Rove, people who have certainly learned how to manipulate the media and mobilize the freak show in the past, are now apparently signing on with the John McCain campaign. Is that right?
Well, I think that you're going to see a united Republican Party come the campaign, the fall campaign, against whichever of the two Democrats emerge. I don't think that there are very many Republicans, if they're honest with themselves, that can say that at the end of the day that it makes more sense for the things that they believe in and want to see accomplished to support anybody other than John McCain in that kind of a situation.
But I'm talking in terms of the ability to take advantage of what's going on the Democratic side. These are guys who know how to do that.
Oh, I think that politics is the business of addition, not subtraction. And I think that you'll see the McCain campaign continue to grow in terms of the number of people involved in it, and you're going to see more and more quality folks jumping on and becoming a part of the campaign.
And John Harris, back to you with the Politico. Interesting things happened during the Texas campaign with Rush Limbaugh telling his listeners to go into Texas and vote for Clinton to keep the soap opera going, as he put it. And then Bill Clinton himself appeared on the program with a guest host, however. How does that relate to the whole idea of the freak show? John Harris? We don't have John Harris. Wanted to ask him, too, how Senator Obama can work his way out of this, in as much as he wrote the book The Way to Win. David Korn, let me ask you about that. What are those who are advising Obama and don't want him to get into this kind of duking it out session with Hillary Clinton suggesting that he can do as an alternative?
Well, you know, up to now, he has tried to, you know, practice and preach this, his new form of politics. And any time he makes a critical statement of Hillary Clinton, the Clinton people jump on it and say, "Oh, so much for the politics of hope." And, you know, trying to, you know, make it hard for him, you know, take away any maneuvering room for him. But we have this, after Mississippi, we have a five-week, you know, run between that and Pennsylvania primary on April 22nd, in which there will be nothing but back and forth between the campaigns, which will largely be shaped by media coverage of it. So I think, you know, whether he wants to or not, he's going to have to find a way not to be a punching bag, to fight back. You know, he was very forceful this morning and somewhat derisive about the Hillary Clinton's latest attacks on him. He's going to have to find a way to do it, and I think he's going to need a bit of a media offensive and be more forthcoming. I don't mean in terms that he's been hiding information, but dealing more with the press, coming out more, doing more interviews, having the press on a bus with him, and sort of out-charm Hillary Clinton, which is not such a hard task.
And Bill Greener, very quickly, what about the Republican campaign, or Republicans in general? Is it true, as conventional wisdom has it, that they would rather run against Hillary Clinton than Barack Obama?
You know, I think what is true of both parties is that we are zero for life in knowing what would be best in that kind of a situation. And I, for one, think that you can make a good case either way. You can say that Hillary Clinton's got a tremendously high floor, even if she's got a low ceiling. I can't imagine that if she ran, she'd get less than 47-48% of the vote. Now, maybe she can only get 51 or 52.
That's enough.
Yeah, that's enough. That's exactly right. And maybe Senator Obama is a candidate that has a wider range of logical and possible outcomes. But it doesn't mean that just because that's the case that somehow you'd rather run against her than him, or vice versa. So I think that you just let Democrats pick the Democrat, and you let Republicans pick the Republican, and you go from there.
Okay. We'll all be watching. Bill Greener, again, Republican strategist, former spokesman for the Republican National Committee. Thanks for being with us. David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. Good to have you. John Harris, editor-in-chief of Politico and co-author of The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. How old is the universe? What happened during its first trillionth of a second? Astronomers are excited about new measurements of the oldest available light that are giving answers to questions like that. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The satellite launched in 2001 has provided new information about the origin of the universe, including its age and its earliest activity. Gary Hinshaw is an astrophysicist with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He's a team member of the Wilkinson Microwave anisotropy probe, also known as the WMAP program. Let us refer to it as that as we go forward. And Gary Henshaw, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What is anisotropy?
Well, anisotropy is differences in different directions. So isotropy is something that's the same in every direction, and anisotropy is something that's different in different directions.
And that's what you're talking about. So the universe is going in all directions. I suppose that's where that comes from.
Well, that's right, yes.
Okay, what did we learn, and what about the age of the universe and new precision and the ability to measure that?
Well, we've been the WMAP satellite's been flying for over 5 years now, and we've been getting a more and more refined picture of the early universe from its data. And so with the new results that we've just come out with, we've measured the age to be 13.7 billion years to within a margin of error of 100 million years. So that's the best determination of that number to date.
Measure of accuracy of 100 million is pretty good if you're talking about 13.7 billion.
We think so, yes.
Yeah. How do you get a picture of the early universe?
Well, the basic idea of the Big Bang Theory is that the universe is expanding, and the laws of thermodynamics imply that as the universe expands, the contents cool. So if you run the clock backwards in time, the early universe was much hotter and denser than it is today. And so the gas in the early universe was emitting light, and that light fills the universe today. It's just zipping around in all directions, and we can measure that remnant light or remnant heat from the early universe, and that light tells us a lot of interesting information about what conditions were like a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang.
What were they like, and what about this question of what happened during the first trillionth of a second?
Well, we think that's really one of the more amazing episodes in the universe's history. What we believe is that the universe underwent a tremendous growth spurt in that first trillionth of a second, and it grew in size by 26 orders of magnitude. That's one followed by 26 zeros in a fraction of a second. Just an astounding time to contemplate. And in the course of that event, it actually planted the seeds for what ultimately would evolve to become galaxies and stars and people.
Now, you say that you can contemplate this, but can you really? I mean, can you really conceive of that in your mind, or is this something that's really a question of mathematics?
We try to conceive of that in our mind as much as possible, but it definitely boils down to mathematics and a careful careful calculations by the theorists and careful data taking by the experimentalists and putting the two together and really testing this idea.
And the ancient light also doesn't look like light anymore. Is that right? It's now in a different form.
That's right. So it was visible light when it was emitted, but since the universe has expanded quite a bit since then, the light itself has expanded, the wavelength of the light. So it's now expanded out to microwaves. To microwave wavelengths, a few centimeters. So that's what we're detecting now is the cosmic microwave background radiation.
And how far away is it?
It's all around us, and it's been traveling across the universe for almost essentially unimpeded for 13.7 billion years, and it finally gets trapped by our detectors. But it's everywhere.
Now, what are neutrinos?
Neutrinos are very weakly interacting subatomic particles, and they've been detected on Earth in particle accelerator experiments. But the neutrinos also were produced in large numbers in the early universe during this hot early phase, and so we believe, just like the microwave radiation we're detecting, that the universe is also filled with a bath of these cosmic neutrinos.
Now, yes. These neutrinos are actually passing through you and me as we speak?
Millions of them every second, yes.
And what do they do? Do they bump into anything?
They don't do anything. They just keep on going. So it would take even a block of lead larger than the entire solar system would not stop one of these cosmic neutrinos.
Wow. Once again, it's very hard for the mind to conceive of, what that would look like.
That's right. But they're out there, so it's... the new results that we have show so subtle evidence for these neutrinos in the microwave background light.
So that's all part of the WMAP program, too, is detecting the neutrinos or confirming their existence. Is that right?
Well, indirectly, yeah. We don't detect them directly, but we see the neutrinos have an effect on the microwave light, and we see that effect.
All right. Then explain to people who, can't get a concept of all of this, why do we want to know this, and why do we spend money to find it out?
Well, this is really getting down to the question of our origins. We've always, civilizations for all of human history have wondered where we come from, and this is the best way our modern civilization has of addressing these questions with astronomical observations and careful comparison of predictions and theories with data.
And the data is increasing very rapidly. You talk about the dark matter and dark energy. We don't have time to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But things that aren't taught in high school physics as yet.
That's right. This dark energy that you alluded to is something that we really have only discovered in the last decade. So school kids now are just going to be the first generations to be taught this. But we have a lot more to learn about that. That's one of the biggest enigmas in cosmology today.
Okay. Well, Gary Henshaw, thanks so much for being with us again with the Goddard Space Flight Center and the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Today's program produced by Gary Scott with Christian Bordahl and Dan Kaunicke. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.